Hello and welcome to another episode of Over Under Movies, where we pick one overrated and one underrated movie within the same genre, style, tone, or director, or however we see fit. This is Oktay Ege Kozak.
And I'm Ryan Oliver.
And this episode we have Ryan's picks, which I would call them police, you know, procedurals or procedures about psychotic killers. And the picks we have are Denis Villeneuve directed 2013's Prisoners.
Why'd you run away from me the other night, man?
I've never seen you before. You sure you have the right house?
You doing some shopping at the Value Mall lately?
Yeah. Why?
Starring Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal as Ryan's overrated pick. So let's start with that before we get to the underrated. Why did you pick Prisoners as your overrated, Ryan?
Well, I've actually had this particular pairing on the back burner for probably upwards of 2 years now. But I think for me with Prisoners, the first time I saw it, and the only time I had seen it up until yesterday, I had... The one thing that I really took, like, the positive I took away from this movie was that it's so confidently directed. Like, despite everything else, there's such a confidence in the way that it's filmed that I knew that Denis Villeneuve, and this was the first movie I had seen of his, was going to go on and make some great films. But I felt weird pinning it as an overrated, like, kind of right off the bat, because I wanted to see what this filmmaker was going to do, and I didn't want to sort of like put a label on this movie until we could see what Villeneuve was capable of.
And would you agree that he didn't disappoint?
No, after an amazing run between Enemy, Sicario, and Arrival, now I finally do not feel guilty coming down on this movie a little bit. Because yes, Villeneuve has gone on to make some incredible films, and Prisoners certainly is not a bad film, but when I saw it in the theater in 2013, I left like fairly underwhelmed and was very like, I felt like I'd watched a different movie from my peers and from a lot of the people, because it was a very well received movie and had a very healthy box office return for a drama of this sort, and a type of movie that doesn't really get made too often anymore. But I feel like the movie is, to me, it's not only overlong, but it doesn't justify its running time, and it builds to a conclusion. Like, it's a message movie. I think that's what ultimately like gets to me, is that the movie doesn't really function,
and
especially on a second.
That fact kind of brings it down too. That
yes,
the fact that it is a message movie and not where the message comes out of the procedural elements. Like, it really tries to twist the procedural into a message movie, and that, I think that was a misstep.
I agree, because the movie doesn't, because of its message, and I wouldn't call this particular movie a message movie, but it reminded me, watching it a second time, of The Game, the David Fincher movie, in that, man, like, whatever it had going for me on the first viewing, it doesn't hold up on a second viewing, because when you know where this movie's going, you realize that there weren't pieces hiding in plain sight, like a way a good twist, like The Usual Suspects or Fight Club or Sixth Sense, where it's like, oh, that was actually in plain sight the whole time. They were really good at holding their hands close to their chest. Whereas this one, when you get to the reveal of the movie, it's not only head slappingly stupid, but also it wasn't built up in an organic or way that you could see that coming. It's just like, oh, bet you didn't see that coming. Well, yeah, because it's stupid. Like, why would we have any reason to have that happen? So I think
it's almost like they're saying we had a shit ton of red herrings, and we went around this like incredibly convoluted way, and then they're finally like, oh, we're at 2 hours and 15 minutes, we have to finish this somehow.
I just slapped on this ending.
That's what it feels like.
Exactly. And I think for me, just because the movie, It takes so long to just hammer out the message that we kind of already knew from the beginning, that I thought of, You know the scene in The Mask before Stanley Imkus puts on the mask for the first time and he's watching television and Ben Stein is explaining
what the mask does.
He's explaining what it does and he says, he's like, you know, we all wear masks, metaphorically speaking. And when I left this movie, I just was like, we all are prisoners, metaphorically speaking.
Yep.
And it's just... the movie is so, again, confidently directed.
The villain monologuing at the end basically hammers in like all of the themes of the story. If you didn't get it,
and we'll be spoiling that, so I apologize.
This is a movie that's when I went back and like looked at my original review, and I called it like a 24-karat execution around a $2 script.
That's a very good way of putting it.
Denis Villeneuve obviously tried really hard to infuse this film with a lot of like deep meaning, and even before the screening started, he apparently had there was the PR guy in charge of the screening came out and just read this whole note from Villeneuve saying, like, I hope that, you know, you will leave this movie thinking about its themes and what the characters did and ask yourself what would you do if you were in the place of these characters and all that stuff. And, you know, I thought that was a little bit arrogant and I was just like, just let us watch the movie first. But it was obviously his way of, like, because he didn't do anything like that with his other movies, like, went to the screening of Arrival. There wasn't, like, a... note from him before that, and that's the only movie that he did that. He didn't do it with Sicario or Enemy. And that made me think as if, like, he knows that he gave it his all to, like, give this film something beyond its, like, very kind of straightforward serial killer thriller script. I mean, this is basically... the overall story of, like, these two girls getting kidnapped and then the investigation into this, like, decades-long serial killer myth that surrounds this town. It's like one of those, like, you know, like the Morgan Freeman, like, Alex Cross thrillers. Like, you can totally see that happening. You can totally see, like, Alex Cross coming into this, like, investigation or something like that. And, like, just you're in and out within, like, an hour and 45 minutes or something. And then that's it. And then you have the exact same thing where it's just like, yes, the obvious bad guy is obvious from the very beginning. But you're just like, oh, this is just an hour and 40-minute thriller, you know. We're certainly going to get to this point at the end where it's like the bad guy's going to monologue and put the gun on the Morgan Freeman. And then some cop's going to show up and shoot him or something like that. And you're just like, just standard thriller or whatever. But to blow this up into this, like, 2.5-hour, like, incredibly heavy-handed behemoth of, like, this,
where of, the intentions like, sacrifice are... and grief yes. and, like, you know, push to the edge.
This really stupid, like, bust-up novel serial killer story is just, it's an absurd combination of tones and maybe it's because Villeneuve came from, you know, doing Incendies, which is a, you know, it's not a great film, as some other people say. It's decent. It's really good. And then you can see why he was hired to do, like, bigger projects from there. But you can definitely tell that maybe around that time he didn't have the power to say, okay, this is really stupid. Like, can we change this around a little bit to make the actual mystery surrounding these kidnappings and killings of these child kidnappings? Like, can we make this a little bit more subtle? Like, make it about the characters and not about, like, all the stupid shit that, like, you know, like, that surrounds it? And maybe he didn't have the power to do that. And I think that explains the reasoning behind his, like, him asking this note to be read before the screening to say, like, yes, I tried to make this about something, but, like, I didn't, maybe he was just kind of coming this message across, like, you know, I didn't really have all the power to make this about something, but I did try. And you can tell that he tried so hard.
Yes, he's caught in that weird middle ground, and you kind of touched on it, and that's like part of my issue with this movie is like it's that weird middle ground where it's like there has to be a thrust for the procedural, for the mystery, but there also needs to be a focus on the characters, or there needs to be like one of them needs to take a backseat to the other. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they're sort of like conjoining at the same time, like equal time is spent. And so therefore it feels like not enough time is spent on either of them. And it's like, mm-hmm. it's one of those things where you said it needed to be trimmed down to like an hour 45, you know, Alex Cross novel type movie,
mm-hmm.
or it needed to be much, much longer and fleshed out.
Like a miniseries.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially like right
like
now,
True Detective. It could have turned into something like
True Detective, or I'm going back through Twin Peaks before the revival starts. And like, mm-hmm. I especially watching that in conjunction with these two movies, that being about a mystery, mm-hmm. you know, equal parts to the mystery and about the characters. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating to see where like this one just stumbles. It stumbles hard. And I think like it's tough because Villeneuve does give it his all. And it's like, I don't want to crap on the movie because it went for something and it missed, like, cause those are usually the type of things that I go for. But I just think, the screenwriter, like looking at his other work, he wrote Contraband with Mark Wahlberg, which is a like enjoyable like B-level movie.
The upcoming like fifth reboot of Friday the 13th.
Exactly. And I'm thinking like, well, number one, the twist of this movie sets it up pretty well for a Friday the 13th, would you yes. think? Like and
with
secondly,
Mama Voorhees, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe Melissa Leo will be cast in the remake.
Reprise the role, yeah.
Exactly. But I think just like looking at this movie, again, it aspires to be more, but I just think it was just out of his grasp. Like the ideas and the themes are certainly there, but they are just brought on with sledgehammer for, like, I have the same issue with this movie that a lot of people do with Batman versus Superman. Like, it's a weird comparison, mm-hmm. but like both movies are overly long and like mm-hmm. dour and are full of like ideas and themes and interesting things. The execution
and the kind of material that doesn't really deserve it, like or
right.
and the kind of material that maybe should have had a bit more levity to it. So in that case, I think it's an apt comparison. And make it, you know, like you said, like make it an hour and 45 minutes of just like an Alex Cross type, like going behind the mystery of like what's going on, and make it about Jake Gyllenhaal's cop character who has this weird like facial tic for some reason. Performance choices sure. with Jake Gyllenhaal are weird. And the fact that we don't really get much of a backstory about him we kind of get the feeling that maybe he's been through situations of like abuse in his past or something, like he has some kind of PTSD, mm-hmm. and that he just cannot when he sees children being kidnapped or abused or whatever, like he makes it personal.
Right.
He really goes.
He also
after.
Has solved every case he's ever solved, so he has.
Yeah,
to,
and that's like such a like exactly like there are elements like that. There's dialogue like that in the film that just belongs straight into the kind of movies that we're talking about, like the
exactly.
kind of like fluffy popcorn thrillers that are based on, you know, like the kind of paperback books you would buy at an airport. There's stuff in that, like it's just like it's the badass detective doesn't play by the rules, solved all every case he's been in, like the whole Gyllenhaal character. And it's also obvious that the actors tried to like add so much that's not in the on the page, and I think that's what Gyllenhaal did. He's just like, I'm gonna give this guy like a facial tic, I'm gonna make him like weird and kind
yeah.
of unsettling to like imply.
I mean, the actors
something
are doing the
it.
Heavy
yeah.
lifting.
Hugh
like,
Jackman
he's
is
doing
great
it.
Like Hugh yes. Jackman really goes all out for it.
For playing, like, you know, he's, you know, just shows how versatile he really is, like, you know, being this like, you know, very suave, attractive Australian man, but he plays a blue collar worker,
like a devout
like,
Christian,
I,
like he sells
Christian.
All that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah,
yeah,
I bought that entirely, but I have to say it's too bad though. Like, I feel like those two are about the only people given room to breathe or room to stretch their wings in this movie. Everybody else just feels like a chess piece in,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it, to spout out, to be a mouthpiece for the themes of the movie.
In
like
a movie
it's
that's
a waste.
Supposed to be a character driven, heavy, like really heavy drama that deals with like themes of like, how can you how easy for people to become monsters when they're pushed to a certain limit, even if you're like a devout Christian who like, you know, really cares about life and all that. And it's just like, and there's all this like incredibly obvious metaphors of like them being hunters, and
yeah,
the beginning is like he hunts the deer and the, you know, they kill the deer and you have to, you know, doesn't he say
saying
like
the Lord's Prayer,
saying the Lord's Prayer. So it's almost like, yeah, you know, you don't have a problem like using God or like the grace of God to like kill another living creature, but like when humans do it to each other and then like that pushes you to become this monster, like there's all this like very easy metaphors which would be, I feel like, which would be more welcome if it was done in the kind of like, you know, popcorn thrillers that we're talking about. If you saw that kind of a metaphor in a popcorn thriller, I'd be like, you know, at least they put in this like nice little touch, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But absolutely. In a film like this, you're just like, you're trying to make something better than this. Like, so it's so obvious. With, you know, Roger Deakins' cinematography is amazing.
Yes. Especially that rescue scene at the end of the movie where like, it's being lit up in the snow by the police lights.
It's beautiful.
It's incredible.
There's some contrast in this film, like just beautiful shots with like this insane contrast, like the shots of like Paul Dano inside the little like the tiny little prison that Hugh Jackman created for him, and you just see like a little bit of his like just mangled face, just terrified, and it's all black apart from that, and it's just, there's some amazing shots in this film. But yeah, like I said, it's like it's all wrapped around this really pedestrian kind of serial killer script that doesn't really know what it wants to be. And
even the police chief in this movie is straight out of like an Alex Cross or like a Jack Reacher. It's like, you don't play by the rules.
Yeah.
Or like, you got to stick by this. And
so that's why I was saying, like
these, what?
Yeah, that's why I was saying either do like an hour and 45 minutes about Jake Gyllenhaal trying to solve this case and have it end with the same kind of like, oh, he finds the bad guy and the bad guy monologues and blah, blah. And then like they get, you know, like it's the ending of like how that ends with Jake Gyllenhaal is like the typical way these movies end. It's like, isn't it? Like, it's like, oh, I can't, you know, since he's a good cop, he can't shoot an unarmed, you know, person, even though if that person's a serial killer. But then, oops, it turns out the serial killer has a gun and she pulls out the gun to shoot him. So now it's self-defense. So now, you know, he can unload on the kill her and kill her, you know. It's all that like typical like cliched stuff, all of that happens. So make it that like for an hour and 45 minutes, or again make it an hour and 45 minutes but make it about what the Hugh Jackman character is going through, how he turns himself into a monster, to like just focus on the torture scenes of like Hugh Jackman kidnapping Paul Dano and like how his friends who also lost their whose daughter's also missing, when they get into it, like I like that, I like the way that he handled especially the moral conflict that the other family is going through.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Hugh Jackman is going through is a very straightforward kind of like, okay when normal people are pushed to the limit, they can become monsters. That's the message, and that message is conveyed within the 2 minutes into like him kidnapping Paul Dano and start torturing, and I'm like, okay, I get the message, and this guy is like determined to go through with this. But I thought the inner conflict of the other couple, Terrence Howard and
Viola Davis,
was a lot more interesting, because they're just like, because there's one point where Hugh Jackman is like, I'm not stopping you, just like let him out, go to the police, do whatever you want to stop this, and they're still like, well, what if it leads to. But they know this is wrong. They know this is horrible.
Right. They're so like, we're not gonna join, but we're not gonna stop.
We're not gonna stop you either. And that's like a more morally, thematically interesting place to be. So I was a lot more interested in that. But like overall, or make an hour and 45 minute movie where it's just like it's all about that story, and don't get into like the mystery of it at all. Like that story, like have that story just end with like the cops just show up and they're just like, oh, it was someone else.
Right.
You don't know how they found it. You don't know how they cracked the case. You don't know how they found the girls and blah, blah. It just turns out to be like, oh, it was someone else. So he just like tortured and like mangled this like completely innocent, mentally challenged boy. And
right.
That would have been something else.
But you can see coming, like, you know, it's not going to be that person. Like, it's very clear from the very beginning. You don't know who it's going to be.
But also the fact that him doing that kind of leads him to solving the case is a little bit problematic. I know that's not the end game, but it might give people the opinion of maybe torture works.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a little bit problematic.
But that at least it's problematic, but it at least adds another like morally gray area, like one other morally gray area to a movie that is otherwise very, but as we've said, straightforward and ham-fisted.
Yeah, and it's very easy to, like, it just goes into all these, you know how, like, every typical Law & Order episode has, like, the first guy that they catch is never the actual guy, because you still have, like, 30 minutes to go? There's like two or three of these in this movie. Like, this movie kind of reminds me of, like, you've seen Labyrinth, right?
Yeah.
And this is a weird starting point, I know, but I have a point. Because these movies have nothing to do with each other. But you know how in Labyrinth, like, Jennifer Connelly comes across this, like, little worm?
Yeah.
Who's, like, who opens the door for her, and then she starts going this one way, and she's like, don't go that way, go the other way. And then the joke is, like, she says, you know, if she went that way, she would have gone straight to the castle. And this movie's kind of like that. If at the beginning they catch the real people, the people who did this, basically. Mm-hmm. So you would have gone, like, if you went through that to that route, and then it makes it, it's like the obvious serial killer is obvious. You know that these are the people who did this. It's so obvious, like, just by the way of, like, I mean, it's okay, spoilers, like, about, like, who it turns out to be, just the way that, like, Melissa Leo carries herself and the way that they dressed her, and, like, they did the, like, they went out of their way to make her weird. And right. I'm like, yeah, it's gonna be her. But there's no good
like build up to that.
No, like, it's just like I said. It's like they're like, oh, we have 15 minutes left. We have to end the movie, and then it just happens. And then it's just like, but then instead of going straight to the castle, you go through this other like insanely convoluted way, of like all this like this priest who killed this guy, and the guy is obviously her husband.
The maze motif,
and this other guy that they catch and turns out to be a copycat and all that stuff. There's so many red herrings, so much filler until you get to the ending that it just becomes more annoying, because you are also engaged in the Hugh Jackman story or the themes of that story, and that's always like intercut with like, yeah, I know this is not going to go anywhere. I know who the killer is. Just fucking get a move on, that kind of thing, you know?
Right, exactly. So that's, I mean, that's, you know, I guess we could probably swing over to the underrated here shortly, but I guess my closing thoughts on this movie is that I haven't fully understand. Like, I get how it could be, you know, powerful for somebody. I could understand that, but I just have never, the movie is just simplicity, but how the way it carries itself with this like thundering importance has always just, it's always bothered me, because the movie should, you know, I think movies should strive to be, you know, more like genre movies can be really good at doing that, but they have to work as a genre movie first and then like bring that message into play. But if you're all about that message and then the movie isn't thrilling,
and then you don't put as much effort into the logic of the mystery that surrounds it.
Exactly. Yeah. Then it just sort of tends to fall apart.
That's always my pet peeve with, especially with directors who want, like, we talked about that with Nocturnal Animals. It was my number one overrated film of last year. And that's kind of where that happens as well, is that, you know, there are some directors who are not really interested in the genre. You know, it might be like an art house director, or it might be someone who's trying to just basically tell a character-based story or a theme-based story within a certain genre that they're not really familiar with. And sometimes this can happen where just, like, directors can really get lost in the artistic side of things before realizing that, you know, like, before, like, fully understanding why this genre works. And that happens. That happened with Nocturnal Animals, in my opinion. That happens with, like, you know, for example, what was it? There was a couple of years ago, there was a movie called Never Let Me Go which was a
Oh yeah, the
sci-fi,
Mark Mnemonic film,
the
right?
sci-fi story about like the clones and everything, which was like it tried to have this like heavy themes about like what it means to be human and all that stuff that a lot of hard sci-fi, like pretty much like 60-70% of hard sci-fi delves into. But then like he didn't spend enough time to like settle the rules and parameters of this universe, so the whole time you're just like saying like, why don't they get in the fucking car and just leave? like why don't they just
Exactly.
escape? Like, when you have like plot holes and then the attitude is kind of like, oh, fuck the plot holes or fuck the plot, like I'm trying to do like this character study here. Well, if you ignore that, it's people are gonna be annoyed. Like, don't be like that. Like, don't be like that. I don't want like artsy dick who's just like, oh, this is not about like, I'm not trying to like do a satisfying plot. Like, you can do both. Like,
Exactly.
and the film's the
And
great,
Villeneuve has done
yeah,
that
has
in
the, and
his subsequent
Arrival, yeah,
films.
that's
Yep.
a, you know,
And
and Sicario, yeah.
Sicario. Yeah, absolutely. So
And
I think,
Enemy in many ways as well is just like, it's a great thriller on top
it
of like
is.
being, and Enemy's a great example of that because the whole point of Enemy is to confuse you anyway. It's like a surrealist David Lynchian film, and even that has like some pretty like amazing thriller elements that you would see in a straight genre film.
It's very effective. And so I think, I think just cut and dry, this script's not up to snuff, as we talked about. And I think that, Villeneuve fortunately got into the studio system and got to show what he could, how talented he was as a director, unfortunately, on a script that he probably didn't really have a lot of say on changing. And therefore, we end up with a gorgeous looking, ambitious, but deeply, deeply flawed movie like Prisoners.
And the one last thing I wanted to say was, the thing that pisses me off about the ending the most is that not only does it rip off the ending to The Vanishing, but it also rips off the ending to the shitty American remake of Vanishing. So it doesn't even have the courage to rip off the grim and dark like original ending of The Vanishing, because it's the exact. Have you seen The Vanishing? Like either one of the
I actually
Vanishings?
haven't, no.
Oh, okay. So it has the exact same ending where the serial killer says like, "Oh, you want to see where you're, In this case, it's Hugh Jackman's daughter, and the other, it's the guy's girlfriend. Is like, you want to go through the same experience? You have to drink this, basically, poison or whatever that's gonna knock him out, and then I'll show you what happened." And then, and then it turns out that like, he just like buried his girlfriend alive. So that's what he does to him. And it's kind of the same situation with this ending, but like the, but it has the ending of the shitty American remake, where the guy is rescued.
You could argue that with like Old Boy. Like it's kind of this like sort of like it's similar to Old Boy, but the American version, not Park Chan-wook's version.
Yeah, so that's like you're obviously like you're directly ripping off another like movie that's not even like obscure. Like a lot of people know that movie. Even if you
Exactly.
haven't seen it, you probably know The Vanishing, right?
Yeah, I know of it. That's what I've never seen it, but I feel like I have based on the knowledge that I have for the
So
movie.
that really bugged me. But anyway, that's the last thing I wanted to say about it. Do you want to move on to the underrated?
Yeah, let's do it.
So Ryan's underrated pick is the Michael Mann directed first Hannibal Lecter movie, Manhunter.
You know who I am?
I don't want to know who you are.
According to you, I'm a sexual pervert. An animal, you said. You know who I am now?
Yes.
Do you feel privileged?
Based on Thomas Harris's book, Red Dragon, which has been adapted, I think, three times so far. So we have Manhunter, we have Red Dragon from 2002,
And the third season of
the
Hannibal
third season of
was.
Hannibal, that's what I heard. I haven't seen Hannibal yet, but so this is our first foray into the Red Dragon, and I haven't seen the Hannibal one, but in my opinion, by the best by a long shot and by a long mile. But yeah, let's ask Ryan why he picked it for underrated.
Well, I think the movie, in addition to just syncing up with Prisoners, I think especially Will Graham and Jake Gyllenhaal's character have a lot of similarities in the way they, carry themselves as detectives and how they've, they never, there's no line that says, Will Graham, you've solved every case you've ever done, but, he's a very, you know, they're very gifted detective. But I think for me, even though this movie, since its release in 1987, has garnered a cult following and has been better received upon like reviewing and reassessment, I still feel like in just the pop culture zeitgeist, because Anthony Hopkins's performance as Hannibal Lecter is so just like, when people think of Thomas Harris's novels, they immediately think of Anthony Hopkins. They like, that's the first thing they think of. And some people, you know, I think film buffs know and love this movie, but some people don't even know this movie exists. They just think that the three movies, mm-hmm. the Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal, and the later Brett Ratner directed Red Dragon, are the like Hannibal movies. And what I love about this movie is that, you know, Hannibal Lecter is, until Hannibal, the Ridley Scott directed movie and that book, they're not about Hannibal Lecter. Like, they're about like contained different stories. And I think what I love about Manhunter is that it doesn't have that baggage, because you don't have that expectation mm-hmm. With that character. And so it's allowed to function as a very like moody, very exciting thriller. And one that, unlike Prisoners, which is very like simplistic in its presentation of both the like heroes and villains and what to go through, this movie has like, that's Will Graham's gift, of course, is to have empathy for the killers. And that's why he's retired, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, hard for him.
He can't live with that in his mind.
Exactly.
Especially after there's this great scene in the supermarket where he's talking to his kid, and he's talking about, like, you know, after my experience with Hannibal, which is, you know, it's interesting that I find it kind of interesting that you didn't pick Red Dragon as your overrated for this, because that movie, even though it didn't get all this like huge critical acclaim or something, it was a success, I think.
But
I feel like critically it got a huge pass. I thought it was just like bargain basement mediocrity, like Brett Ratner,
I think for me to you know, we tend to shit on Brett Ratner a lot. I'm going to not do it so much. I'm going to give him just a tiny bit of credit. I think for Red Dragon, despite its mediocrity, I think that movie did have the baggage of this movie already existing. Mm-hmm. And so if Brett Ratner had just made it, I'd be like, you know, it's a very mediocre movie as a whole, but mm-hmm. for him, far and away the best movie he's made.
Default.
But I think the reason I didn't pick Red Dragon is because I don't think we'd have a lot to discuss.
We would just be talking about the similarities. Yeah.
And like,
talk about the similarities and be like, oh, this is, you know,
this is
you
good.
You want to watch a mediocre, you know, like a crappy, you know, not crappy, right, but like, you know, just soul-crushingly mediocre version of like.
Yes, it's so like shot. Like, it's mostly shot for shot, except for the, like the unnecessary prologue at the beginning.
And the epilogue.
They
have to add that, and that's what I was gonna like kind of talk about in regards to that like scene in the supermarket. You know, you don't see the scene where William Peterson, that character played by Edward Norton in Red Dragon, you don't see the scene where he catches Hannibal. He just talks about it in this like very kind of almost bland location, like there he's just shopping with his son, and he just goes into like what happened and how Hannibal like attacked him. And
but that's how you would explain it to an 8-year old. Like,
yeah,
you
yeah,
like,
but you, but you don't have to see it. And it's that's the difference between Michael Mann and Brett Ratner, is that Michael Mann knows the intensity of that backstory can be applied through the simplicity of that scene, and the simplicity is what makes it effective, because you're just like, wow, this guy like went through some shit, and then your imagination kind of fills in the rest about like how sick this Hannibal Lecter guy must have been for him to finally be like, I didn't want him in my head anymore, so I had to quit the job. So that's just like, that stuff is like so much more effective than just, okay, we have to show. And also in Red Dragon, they were at a position where like we have to cram in Anthony Hopkins in as many scenes as possible.
And that's the thing. That's why this movie is free of that burden, because it was made before Anthony Hopkins made that role iconic. And so Brian Cox is only in like what, 3 scenes in this movie?
Hannibal, he's great.
He's great. It's effective. I love the first scene where like it's point of view on both of them. Both of them are framed in the jail cell bars, like dead center, and it just cuts between them through and through. Love that stuff. And Michael Mann is so good at just, like, you know, you mentioned the supermarket scene. Michael Mann's always been good at showing you, he will show you what he wants the audience to see at any given time. Like when he gives you the exposition, he knows he's giving you the exposition. It's not like a lazy way of doing that. Like, he's like, this is the moment, this is the right time. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it is just, it's an incredible mood piece. And
a very, very tightly streamlined procedural too.
Yes, very tightly streamlined. And God, so much credit to William Peterson as Will Graham, because mm-hmm. in the Hannibal series, which is very good, if you haven't seen it, they, you know, because of it being, you know, the 2015 and 16, whenever the show came out and all the technology they could use, they would, like, have these tracking shots and these, like, digital recreated shots of Will Graham in the Hannibal series, seeing all the events that, like, literally walking in the killer's shoes. Mm. But Michael Mann didn't have that technology or that budget at the time. Mm. So William Peterson has to, like, convincingly show the audience what he is seeing at that mm-hmm. time, even though we're just seeing him walking through a room. We're just seeing him walking through a crime scene, but he's narrating in his little voice recorder of mm-hmm. what he's seeing. And it's effective. Like, it's mm-hmm. almost more effective, you know, as you said, because they don't show, it's like the same thing of
it's not
having the
epilogue. It's not showy. Yes, it's not over showy. The top. It's not obvious. But
and your
that,
mind
that's,
will make it more yeah. creepy, honestly. And especially, like, pair that with the synth score.
Yeah, and
you,
the
like,
synth
you're...
score is, like, moody, and it gets you into, like, it's perfect. Like, the it gets you into this, I don't know if that was the exact, you know, because those kinds of scores were in every kind of movie back then. So it wasn't, you know, that kind of synth score wasn't specifically used in thrillers or horror movies. But it really does, like, if the intention is to get you, like, an unease mood, like, it does an amazing job. Like, there's something about yeah. the synthesizer that, like, you know, going back to, like, the you know, Dawn of the Dead or the giallo movies of, like, Dario Argento and stuff like that, they add so much to the experience. And they, you know, some movies, like, you know, It Follows, like, try to ape it today, but I think it's just the fact that those weren't, like, callbacks, they were actual genuine attempts of, like, putting you into that mood, what is what makes those films, the scores in those films, so much more special as the films today that are trying to, like, kind of do a throwback to those.
Exactly.
It works organically.
It does. And the movie's, like, just minimalist approach. The fact that it's, like, because you said it's not showy. I think, like, early criticism when the movie first came out is people did think it was showy and they thought it was style over substance. And, you know, maybe we're so saturated with style in the movies that are made today.
Now it
that
looks so much more subtle.
Quaint.
Yeah.
It looks so much more subtle, especially because there are moments in the movie that are, like, you know, it's so subdued that when a moment does hit, like the flaming wheelchair scene, for example, mm-hmm. it's like, it's terrifying. Like, that image is ingrained
in your face, yeah.
in my mind for the rest of my life. And I love, you know, again, I was kind of getting to this track at the beginning, you know, versus Prisoners, and kind of why I wanted to pick the two is because of between Prisoners' simplistic approach in this movie, having, like, you know, deep empathy, not just for Will Graham, but, like, even a terrible psychopath like Francis Dolarhyde, like the fact that he's in his mind and that there's, like, a sort of duality and a similarity between the two, but they're two sides of a different coin. Is, like, it's a fascinating moral gray area to be in, where
and
Prisoners doesn't have anything like that.
You do get the kind of straightforward exposition monologue about, like, why he
yes.
can easily enter the minds of these, like, depraved individuals. But I think, like, Michael Mann deserves so much more credit there, and the performance by William Peterson, in the way that they make it, like, very matter of fact. It's not a big moment. It's not a, like, okay, this is where we're going to, like, lay out the themes of the story. It's just a moment where they're just waiting. There's these two police, like two detectives waiting for, like, answers. And then just, like, they start shooting the shit. And then he just, like, goes into, you know, can you be empathetic towards a child who was abused, but also want to kill that child when it becomes an adult and starts killing other people? And that's a great, like, dichotomy that he, that's a very interesting dichotomy that he puts himself into, where he has, like, this amazing empathy for what could have transpired in these people's lives to turn them into this, but then also be like, I need to catch you as soon as possible and put two bullets into your head because you can't, like, be alive.
Right.
And to have this kind of, like, very cut and dry position that's wrapped around this really interesting place to be. But he does it in a way that's just, like, just focuses on the actor sitting on a chair, just delivering the monologue. And it's, like, it's not handled as this, like, big dramatic moment, and I think that's what makes Manhunter work so well. And for me, it's like, it's almost like this is not my favorite Hannibal Lecter movie. You know,
Silence of the Lambs
is definitely the one.
It's a masterpiece. Like I hate to use that word,
Silence of the Lambs is great in terms of. But this might be my personal favorite movie that has Hannibal Lecter in it.
I watched this one probably. No, I revisit this one more often than I do. Maybe mainly because I think even though the movie is like heavy, it's still, but there's like, there is a stylistic flourish to the movie that I, and mm-hmm. a atmosphere that I love getting lost in, where Silence of the Lambs, despite being a masterpiece, is, it's a grind because it is so like unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
And again, so is this one, but like,
this is more of an accessible, just, like detective thriller, but that's
exactly.
done in an excellent way.
And that's the other thing I love about Michael Mann as a whole, but especially in this movie, like he knows how to make like no BS police procedural, but mm-hmm. make it look like interesting, because like he just understands the worlds of cops, the worlds of police. And he, you know, Dennis Farina is in this movie, who was a former cop, who's great in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And he just like he knows the grind of like building a case. And so, like, to see that in his style is just, it's really exciting to watch. And it's interesting, I was doing my research of this movie, and apparently David Lynch was originally attached to direct it, and who might be my favorite filmmaker, but I don't think he would have been right for this movie as much as I love him. Because
it would have been
like,
too weird.
It would have been too weird and, like, too emphasis on the mood, and this movie has a perfect, like, mood and like narrative thrust balance. I also think like in college I did a critical analysis on, or I did my history narrative film paper on Blue Velvet, and in doing my research, the Dino De Laurentiis put out this movie, and David Lynch had signed a two picture deal with Dino De Laurentiis, one to do Dune and one to do a movie of his choice. And Dune was such a terrible experience for both of them, and they basically hated each other after that. That he gave him, the Dino De Laurentiis gave David Lynch peanuts to do his next movie, which ended up being Blue Velvet. But I'm assuming that David Lynch was like, I don't want any part to do with another adaptation after doing Dune. So he was
he was just like, I don't want, you know, I want to do my own thing. Like, I don't want to be, maybe he was petty about like, I don't want to like bow down to like whatever script that you're going to send me. I want to do my own thing. Maybe, I don't know. But I think, yeah, Michael Mann is the perfect choice for this material. And I love the way that he mixes situations and scenes that could be over the top and makes them grounded. Like, you have an insane ending here where it's like this police raid right when he's about to kill the blind woman that he's dating, the Tooth Fairy, the killer.
With Inigata
DeVita. Perfectly synced to the events. Like, there's this like great, like the big guitar riff kicks in when William Peterson like crashes through the, you know, it's almost borderline schlock, but he grounds it somehow.
He also plays with frame rates on that scene.
Yeah, and
it's
fun up. And it's like out there, but it's not gaudy and it's not annoying.
Yeah,
he does it in a way that just like fits the kind of grounded, relatively grounded tone of the rest of the film.
Right,
and that's
but it
a
also
very
still
hard
has
thing
that
to accomplish.
It has that otherworldly. It is hard to accomplish, but it has that otherworldly element to it.
Yeah, it's not bland.
Not at all. So when that scene does like, you know, the movie still has this like interesting universe to where that. Even if it could be perceived as schlock, it's incredibly effective. Even the like symbolism is like, you know, not it's a little heavy-handed at the end, but it's still like it's effective because the movie, it did the legwork and it did the build up to that.
Well, at least it's not like the ending of Psycho where a psychiatrist shows up and is like, this is what he's going through, and this is why he acted like this, and
right,
you know, exactly. It's a fairly simple, like, okay, this is what he wanted to do, that's why he was acting the way he did, and that's why he was attracted to, you know, without any straight exposition delivered to you understand why he's attracted to the blind woman, and how it like informs his and like in a way I think Red Dragon almost hints at you that like because of his relationship with the blind woman that he's going to change his ways or something,
right?
And there's not even an attempt at that in Manhunter, which I love.
Yeah.
Like, you're no, like, yeah, no, why would he change, like, because he's like watching the home video of the family that he's gonna kill next, right when she's sitting right next to him, and he takes pleasure out of the fact that she can't see, so he's doing this like disgusting thing while mm-hmm. you know, she thinks he's just looking at like homework or something. And that's like, it manages to be truly unsettling without really just like pushing it in your face.
Yes, I agree.
And that's what really works about it. And another example of that, like compared to Red Dragon, for example, is, you know, in Manhunter, William Peterson is just standing in the middle of this bedroom that's just like messed up and it's covered in blood.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrifying. It's horrible looking. But like Michael Mann just uses, he doesn't use music. He doesn't use like, you know, he just uses a general like long shot of the room while he's just talking into his tape recorder about like, oh, this person might have had his throat cut or in this spot, and then he wanted to save the kids, so he must have been dragging himself. And then you see like you track the, but it's done in a very like procedural, matter of factly way, and that's what makes you feel, that's what gives the intensity of the scene, because you're just like, this is horrifying, like what he's describing. It's like your worst possible nightmare as a family man. Yeah. And but the way that he's describing in this like matter of fact way, is that's what like gives you like this haunting feeling. And you look at Red Dragon, the same scene where it's just like, you know, like Edward Norton goes into the bedroom and like turns on the light and you see the blood on the bed or whatever, and there's like this like loud musical sting. It's like da da da, like, you know, it's like
it has to hit all those big broad
beats. Notes, and it has to make you like, look at this, look at all this blood I'm showing you, like Brett Ratner being like, I'm a big boy filmmaker now, like I'm making all these like violent serial killer movies. It's almost like that, and it's just so off-putting that
it is. And while I think that movie again is just like just plain mediocre, it's not terrible, it's not good, it's just this mediocre movie. It's weird, people give that movie a pass over Ridley Scott's movie. I would take Ridley Scott's Hannibal like head and shoulders over.
Oh yeah, because at least it's weird.
It's so bizarre. Oh my god, that movie's so histrionic. It takes and some crazy.
Like crazy chances. Like I still can't believe that was a studio release. Like the ending of that movie. Like
I feel like because it was Ridley Scott and because it was a sequel to Silence of the Lambs, they got away with so much in that movie. I guess
like that movie's a mess. Like it's a complete mess.
It's so messy.
It's totally all over the place, and that's some like weird shit in it in a way that just like doesn't fit, like going back to like, because the only movie reference you had before that with Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter was Silence of the Lambs, and that's a tightly constructed movie.
Yes,
and
like, no
moving
battle.
From that to Hannibal, where it's just like this batshit crazy like all over the place story.
Yeah, and it's like a straight giallo movie almost.
yeah exactly. It was weird. So then going from that to like Red Dragon was like playing it safe, and so at least I give Hannibal a little bit of credit for that. Like people would probably, a lot of people would say like, oh, it's Red Dragon's better than Hannibal because it's a better structured film, I guess. But you know, it also doesn't take any chances. That's why they hired Brett Ratner.
Super safe. It's super cut and dry. And
yeah.
And I was going to say, like, back to this movie, like, you know, before we, you know, start to wrap up, it's kind of a shame that after this movie, Michael Mann never really dipped his toe in the horror thriller genre. Like he did this and The Keep right before it, which is a batshit crazy movie. Also messy, but
If
at least
you can find
kind
The Keep, I think it's out of print everywhere. It's a very hard film.
You
to
can
find.
Get it digitally on like iTunes and Amazon.
Oh, you can now?
But it's in standard def.
Because it's been in like some litigation for like the longest time, and like it wasn't released for like the longest time. Maybe they got over it now. So yeah, you should definitely check that movie out. It's not, I wouldn't call it good or great, but
it's
crazy.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Super interesting.
Definitely.
And that was his second movie, this being his third movie after The Key.
The Great
Thief,
yeah.
Yeah, Thief, which is a great movie. But it's too bad. I'm wondering if the initial reception and box office returns for both The Keep and Manhunter, because neither were successful in their time, just kind of soured him from touching this genre again, because he's mostly made crime movies mm-hmm. or biopics.
Yeah, that's a shame, because he would have been I feel like he would have been really great at it. The closest I feel like he came to, even though it's not technically a serial killer, would be Collateral, I think. It almost has like kind of a running away from the serial killer horror movie approach. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right. It also has the thing. Well, between that and of course, Heat and the diner scene, like the sort of dualities, the same side or the different sides of the same coin that Michael mm-hmm. Mann is so good at doing. And I think that, you know, people obviously Heat's a masterpiece and Collateral's a very good movie, but I think that what he became so good at doing started in this movie, and I think people don't totally realize that.
Yeah, and so I would definitely say, if you haven't seen Manhunter, but if you're big fans of both Heat and Silence of the Lambs, this is one that I would heavily recommend to check out.
Absolutely, and I just recommend in general. It's a movie that I've I've always loved. I first saw it in college when I was like going through filmmakers that I admired and was like going through their filmography, and then got to Manhunter when I was watching Michael Mann's films, and it's been a personal favorite since then, and I just think it needs a little bit more love than it gets.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think my last note would be kind of a shout out to Tom Noonan. I think he's great as the killer.
So terrifying, and so like again that minimalist approach. And he apparently did not want to see any of the cast for scenes
so
that
he
was not
going to
be
part approach,
of.
And you can see how that worked out. Like people seem truly like off put by him, and. It's really interesting, and he does an amazing job, and he's
even better than Ralph Fiennes in Red Dragon.
Oh, hell
who
yeah.
is, and Ralph Fiennes is one of our greatest actors working today.
Yeah, but he's kind of asleep at the wheel in that role, and I hate that kind of Hollywood approach of like, oh, this guy is supposed to be hideous, so let's cast Ralph Fiennes, who's like genuinely good looking, and just just slap just put a scar on his face or something.
Well, it took so long because he had played Amon Garth in Schindler's List, so like people wanted to keep casting him in a role like that.
Yeah, I can see that, but he's like, but the whole point of that character is that he's supposed to be hideous, and that's supposed to be what drives him to do what he does.
Yeah,
and
Tom Noonan's just like, in addition to just being he's a terrific actor, but like he does have this off-puttingness to him, and he's mm-hmm. tall, so he's incredibly like physically imposing.
Yeah. So I think he's great, and I think he's this is the only one where it's like the Brian Cox is great too, because of how much more straightforwardly handled he is than Hannibal Lecter. He's not as showy, and that's what makes him eerie more eerie, the way that he talks about like killing people makes us feel like gods, but he doesn't do it in this like Anthony Hopkins like weird like just going like like that kind of sounds. Like he just does it, he's just like laying on his like bed and like in a cell.
Yeah. He's very matter of fact.
He's very matter
saying,
of fact, yeah,
but
exactly.
Saying really fucked up things.
But
so
saying really, really fucked up things, like saying like, makes us feel like a god when we kill people. And so that's the best approach to that. But this is the only movie I can think of in the Hannibal Lecter kind of features that where the other killer overshadows, like becomes the main focus, overshadows
right.
Hannibal Lecter. And I think Tom Noonan manages to do that here. Definitely. So yeah, a little bit of a shout out to him. I think he's kind of an underrated actor, who's been in recently a lot of Charlie Kaufman stuff. So
every voice in Anomalisa.
Every other voice in Anomalisa that's not the boy on the girl. Or he's great in Synecdoche. So that's my final note. Do you have any final notes about it?
No, I said my piece before your final notes. So other than that, go watch Manhunter. And I mean, if you haven't seen Prisoners, there is still you know, there's ambition to it, but it's not something you need to.
It's too long. If it was like shorter, I would say like, you know, at least watch it for the performances and the way it's shot. But man, it's too long.
It's way too long.
You know, it doesn't deserve like, it's almost 3 hours, man. That's a lot for a film like that, especially one that's so predictable.
It's true. If you need your Villeneuve and Jake Gyllenhaal fix, watch Enemy because it's 90 minutes long.
Yes.
And better.
Yes. There you go. That's a great advice. So yeah, thank you so much for listening to our police procedural serial killer episode. Our next episode is going to be my picks, and we're going to do something a little bit different this time around. Instead of picking one overrated and one underrated movie, in order to kind of celebrate the new existence of Filmstruck, where you can watch a lot of Criterion releases, in order to kind of also celebrate the beauty of the Criterion catalog, these are going to be my picks. And I decided to kind of talk about three Criterion releases, some of them out of print, some of them that didn't get the Blu-ray upgrade yet, that I think really deserves, an upgrade, a new Blu-ray release or something like that, if Criterion is listening. But anyway, so my picks are going to be three films that the Criterion Collection released that don't really have any thematic or genre connections between them, but the first one is going to be Federico Fellini's Knights of Cabiria. The second one is going to be Kon Ichikawa's great anti-war film, The Burmese Harp, and the third one is going to be Samuel Fuller's great anti-racism film from I think 1980 or 1981 called White Dog. Not to be confused with another dog-based movie, White God. That's the Hungarian film from a couple years ago. So yeah, it's called White Dog from the early 80s, and these are all, I think, you can find them in video stores, or some of them can be found streaming. They're fairly hard films to find, but they're definitely worth it if you want to like kind of prepare for the next episode. So those are the ones that we're going to be talking about next time. But until then, thank you so much for listening to us on the Playlist Podcast Network. You can always find new episodes on the podcast section on theplaylist.net. We want to thank the Playlist for still hosting us and letting us talk to you through them. And also you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/overundermovies, on Twitter at overundermovies. And also you can also find us on iTunes under the Playlist Podcast. So yeah, if you listen to us and if you like our show, like give us a comment and subscribe and do all that cool stuff, please. And signing off, this is Oktay Ege Kozak. I'm a contributor and film critic for The Playlist, The Oregon Herald, DVD Talk, and BeyazPerde.com.
And signing off is Ryan Oliver. I'm a contributor here to ThePlaylist.net and the editor of the very podcast you are listening to right now.
Yay! All right, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.